Wind will be from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. It's 71 and fair. That's KPR weather.
You know, it's one of the few places now you're completely in charge of your own life. You're steering your own course. The road is providing you with a sense of direction. You've got this sort of liberation. You're seeing the landscape at your own pace.
That's Rolf Smith, and I'm Dan Skinner. Ahead on Conversations, we'll talk about 100 bike rides of a lifetime, the world's ultimate cycling experiences. Also, bicycle journalist Peter Flax.
I would just always recommend that to people of like accessing this childlike part to discover things, to go somewhere you haven't been on a bike, and just go a little further than you've gone before.
We'll discuss Live to Ride, finding joy and meaning on a bicycle. Two books about bicycling. That's ahead on Conversations. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Joel Snyder. In the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights, families gathered today for funeral processions for the 12 children and young adults killed in a rocket attack that hit a soccer field where they were playing yesterday. Thousands of mourners attended the funeral ceremonies in the village dominated by the Druze community. Israel is blaming the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah for the attack. The Israeli military says it targeted several Hezbollah targets in Lebanon overnight. There are no reports of casualties, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the price has yet to be paid. Hezbollah denies any role in the attack. Former President Donald Trump tested out attack lines against Vice President Kamala Harris during a campaign rally in St. Cloud, Minnesota last night. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports that Trump said Harris made Senator Bernie Sanders look like a moderate.
Former President Donald Trump is seeking to regain the spotlight from Vice President Kamala Harris, who has generated significant momentum since launching her campaign. In St. Cloud, Minnesota, Trump attacked her on inflation and immigration. He charged Harris as a radical who would impose San Francisco values on the country.
Kamala Harris was the original Marxist district attorney. She destroyed San Francisco, and she will destroy our country. She will be the worst president we've ever had. She will be worse than crooked Joe Biden.
Trump's attacks have been increasingly personal against Harris as he's sought to wrestle attention away from the likely Democratic nominee, who has moved quickly to rally support. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
The Harris campaign says it's raised $200 million since she emerged as the likely Democratic presidential nominee last week, and that most donations came from first-time contributors this election cycle. In southern India, people in Harris's ancestral village offering prayers that she'll win in November, Amkar Kandakar reports.
Over the past week, some residents of Tulasendrapuram have prayed for Kamala Harris's victory at a local temple every day. Local politician Arunmoy Sudhakar says that while Harris's grandfather left the village nearly 100 years ago, they still think of her as the daughter of the land. But some are also hoping to benefit out of this association. Residents say that once they got the spotlight after Harris became the vice president, a local bank started offering them loans. The village librarian R. Usha says if Harris becomes the president, someone might step in to fix the potholes too. For NPR News, I'm Omkar Khandekar in Mumbai.
The suspect linked to that big wildfire burning near Chico, California, is expected to be arraigned tomorrow. The Park Fire is the largest in California so far this year. Firefighters battling the blaze are getting some help from the weather this weekend. And from Washington, this is NPR News. Venezuelans are going to the polls today to decide whether to hand President Nicolas Maduro a third term. The election is being called Venezuela's most consequential in 25 years. Maduro has warned of a bloodbath if he loses. He's facing a stiff challenge from a coalition of opposition parties that have united behind Edmundo Gonzalo Urrutia, a retired diplomat. Speaking in Japan today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged political leaders in Venezuela to respect the democratic process. The first day of the Paris Olympics, full of big developments, including Team USA's first gold medal after a strong showing in the men's 4x100-meter freestyle relay. NPR's Juana Summers reports there's no shortage of action in store today.
All eyes are on the five members of the U.S. women's gymnastics team ahead of today's qualifying round. The team is headlined by Simone Biles and features three other Tokyo Olympians. Also, don't miss what's sure to be a showdown in the men's 100-meter breaststroke final, where Great Britain's Adam Peaty is looking to win his third consecutive gold medal in the event. And coming off a dominant win against Zambia, the U.S. women's national soccer team faces Germany today in Marseille. Juana Summers, NPR News, Paris.
Organizers at the Paris Olympics were forced to cancel today's training session for triathletes following the heavy rain in Paris that affected pollution levels in the Seine River. However, officials say they are confident that water quality will improve before the triathlon events begin on Tuesday with the men's race. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Good morning, and welcome to Conversations. I'm Dan Skinner. Today, the focus is on bicycling. Later in the program, I'll talk with Peter Flax. He's a Los Angeles-based writer, a lifelong cyclist, and an editor who's covered sports, adventure, and culture for over 30 years. We'll talk about Live to Ride, finding joy and meaning on a bicycle. First up, a conversation with Rolf Smith. He is an award-winning magazine writer and photographer and longtime contributor to National Geographic. He joins us to talk about his latest book, 100 Bike Rides of a Lifetime, the world's ultimate cycling experiences. Rolf, welcome to the program.
Well, it's lovely to be here.
Well, before we talk about the book itself, tell us more about how you became such an avid bicycling enthusiast.
Well, I got my first bike when I was about 7. I wasn't expecting a bike. We didn't have a lot of money, but my mother had very quietly put away money. And one day I got off the school bus and I had no idea I was going to get a bike. And she'd gone and parked the bike in our driveway as though it were like a car. My first thought was, who's visiting us? My second thought was, how did they get here so fast ahead of the school bus? And then I see my mother peeking out the window. She's all excited. And I realized that bike is mine. And you know, it wasn't a new bike. It was a secondhand girl's bike, a Schwinn bike, very old, chunky. To me, it was beautiful. I couldn't care what it was. It was a bike. And I was out exploring. To me, it was always a ticket to ride. It was a ticket to explore and go places, a bit of freedom. And I think it really ratcheted up a notch a few years later. I was about 14. The May 1973 issue of National Geographic lobbed on our doorstep. And in it was a story about four cyclists who were doing the Alaska Highway. Well, I was absorbed. I mean, I to this day can describe all the images that were in that story. They were just seared in my mind. And funnily enough, I've never done the Alaskan Highway, but I was seized with the ambition to explore the world on a bicycle because suddenly I saw, I mean, I'd imagined you could do it, but then I thought, why, you know, I would say these things and the adults would smile. Yes, yes, that's nice. Yes, of course you're going to ride to Zanzibar. Of course you are. And you know, suddenly I see in National Geographic, you really can do this kind of stuff. I mean, the world is open. And so I conceived this idea that one day I was going to explore the world on a bicycle. And secondly, that I was going to contribute to National Geographic magazine. Now, it took a long time. What a circuitous route before I actually got there. But that's ultimately what happened. And my first story for National Geographic, funnily enough, was a cycling story. It was a three-part series about a 10,000-mile bike ride around Australia. I did completely off my own bat. I left my job at Time Magazine, put some stuff on a bicycle. I was working out of the Sydney office, put some stuff on a bicycle, headed north up the coast, and 9 months later was back again, having done 10,000 miles all over the bush, staying in Aboriginal communities, sheep stations, cattle stations, remote police outposts, mining camps, and just really explored the country. And that ultimately became a three-part series in the magazine and kick-started my career with National Geographic, which has taken me all over the world, not just on cycling stories, but many other topics as well.
Describe this book for us. What are readers going to find here?
Well, hopefully they'll find something for everybody. The brief was 100 bike rides of a lifetime. And, you know, I'm not a mountain biker myself. So, you know, but I didn't want to have it all just road bike type stuff. I want to have, you know, something for everybody. So there's mountain bike rides, there's road bikes, there's gravel bike rides, there are long expedition rides, there are day trips for families. They are on 6 continents around the world. Easy, hard. The only criteria was that the rides had to be special in some way, something really memorable that set them apart from other things. Problem is, you know, you start off with something like that, and, you know, 100 rides seem like that's plenty. But, you know, I had to pare down and pare down and pare down. I mean, there are so many lovely bike rides out there, many of which deserve to be in the book. And, you know, I think I put in the introduction, you know, people are going to be reading this and thinking, well, why did you leave out so-and-so and so-and-so? And I can only stick my hand up and say, yeah, I agree. I just had 100. And, and try to have a mix, too. I was shooting a cycling event in the Dolomites, Italy, in September. And I was talking with a professional mountain bike mechanic, been all over the world. And he did the tour circuit. And he's just casually telling me about some mountain bike routes that I'd never heard of. I mean, one that goes down 500 meters below ground in a lead mine in Slovenia, where he said it's, you know, the most amazing ride he'd ever done in his life. And I'm thinking, why didn't I see you a year ago when I was putting this together? And he's telling me about following the old partisan trails from World War II in the Italian Alps. They're known to him and a bunch of other people in the mountain biking fraternity, but I had no idea. So, you know, I often feel that there ought to be an annex book, you know, the 100 rides that should have been in the book that weren't, and perhaps even another edition after that. Because there's so much out there.
So, Roth, who do you see as the audience for this book? Obviously, those people who would like to actually take some of the journeys you describe on their bicycles. But I imagine it would also appeal to armchair travelers as well.
Well, hopefully, yes. I've tried to write the copy so that there's history, there's color. Because, yes, there's, you know, I mean, I'm not a mountain biker at all. But, you know, a couple of the rides, and they really captured my imagination. Somebody asked me, you know, some of my favorite rides in the book, and I mentioned one called the Whole Enchilada, which is, to me, an absolutely harrowing, terrifying ride down the side of this mountain in Moab, Utah. But I was absorbed in the research and thinking, wow, you know, I'll never do it. There's just no way. I've got way too much imagination to want to hurdle 8,600 feet down a mountainside. But so I'm hoping people will look at it that way. Maybe someone who is a mountain biker will think, oh, no, I'm not interested in road biking, but no, that's a kind of a cool story about that pass over the Alps that's very famous in the Tour de France. I'm thinking here of the Tourmalet, which is also one of the rides. You know, if you're interested in the history of cycling, you know, that's a classic. You know, 1913, you have these riders going up over this completely unmade road over a mountain pass, and the guy getting to the top screaming at the organizer of the Tour de France, "You're murderers trying to kill us," you know, and they were, you know. So there's so much history, and so I'm hoping people will look at that and perhaps get ideas of things they might want to do. I mean, a guy I know is into motorcycles, not bikes, but he has a copy of the book. And he's looking at some of the rides in Europe, these, you know, mountain passes, and thinking, whoa, I could do this. You know, so there's rides that, you know, whether you're armchair travelers, whether you're on a motorcycle, whether you just want to go to a place and just get some ideas about what's in the area. So hopefully there'll be, yeah, a lot of scope there for armchair travelers to sit and have a nice read. So by no means do you need to be fit. By no means do you need to even own a bicycle. Hopefully you can read this, see the images, and feel either that you've been somewhere or that maybe you want to go somewhere.
Bicycling has always been popular in Europe, but it seems like here in the United States, more and more people are getting into bicycling. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of reasons for it. Environmental health, I mean, those are the kind of sort of more worthy, if you will, reasons for it. But also I think there's a lovely bit of escapism that a bicycle offers. You know, it's one of the few places now you're completely in charge of your own life. You're steering your own course. The road is providing you with a sense of direction. You've got this sort of liberation. You're seeing the landscape at your own pace. You're able to meet people and interact with people, because on a bicycle, people are willing to approach you. And if you approach someone, you're, you know, stop and think about the movies. You know, other than Elmira Gulch in The Wizard of Oz, has there ever been a baddie on the bicycle? We're always the, you know, the offbeat vicars, the little old ladies who solve murders in small English villages. You know, it's, you know, so you're not threatening to anybody. So, you know, I think there's this lovely escapism to a simpler, quieter age, which I certainly find that in here in England. I disappear down the little lanes. I use a 1919 Ordnance Survey map. It works just fine. I don't have a GPS on my bike. I have this 1919 Ordnance Survey map, and on the little lanes, they still work. You come up to these little signs over here in Britain, the little signposts back in these lanes, and you'll see something like, you know, Dolam Halt, 3¾ miles. You stop and think about that. We're looking at an age where a quarter of a mile made a difference. We didn't round up to 4 miles. It was 3¾ miles. That, you know, that you're at in an age where the world was bigger, life was on a village scale, and you can kind of escape into that world. And I think there was a desire for sort of simplicity and a gentleness that you find on a bicycle.
In the book, as you describe each of those rides, you rate them according to level of difficulty. And if someone is considering doing something that might be a bit more challenging, what advice do you have for them?
Well, find something that you're definitely going to enjoy. I mean, there's some rides in there that, you know, you definitely are not going to want to do if you're just starting out. But, you know, rails to trails, there's no traffic. There's tend to be low grades, you know, very, very easily, no steep hills, nicely firm, packed surfaces. Things like, you know, I mean, there are a number of rails to trails routes in that book in America, and there's some lovely routes over here in Britain, or in Britain and Europe as well. My favorite in the whole book there, favorite ride that I've ever done, is following the Danube. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And the cycle path along there is largely traffic-free. There's hardly any hills because the river is taking care of all that for you. And you're following this majestic river through this sort of classic rural European landscape. Anyone can do it. You see people out there cycling with their families. You know, kids 5 and 6 years old. You know, they go. There's a 200-mile stretch between Passau, Germany, and Vienna. You know, kids, tiny, small kids with their families ride that one. Grandparents, 70, 80 years old, they ride it. I mean, it's not hard, but there's still at the end of it, you've ridden 200 miles. So you have this great sense of achievement and an adventure. And that's what a lot of the rides, I hope, here will be about. Accessible adventure that people, anyone can enjoy. And there are some rides in there that you definitely want to be on top of your game before you even think about. But there's a lot of rides in there that are for everybody.
The book is 100 Bike Rides of a Lifetime, The World's Ultimate Cycling Experiences by Rolf Smith. Rolf, thank you for talking with me today.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Conversations. And to learn more about all of the things you can hear on Kansas Public Radio, visit our website, kansaspublicradio.org. Is a Los Angeles-based writer and editor who has covered sports, adventure, and culture for over 30 years. A lifelong cyclist, Flax has written about bike culture with a focus on advocacy, racing, and the beauty of the lifestyle. He's the former editor-in-chief of Bicycling, the largest bike-related magazine in the world, and he's currently the U.S. editor-in-chief of The Red Bulletin, an active lifestyle magazine. Since moving to Los Angeles a decade ago, he's commuted exclusively on his bike, pedaling nearly 100,000 miles to and from his job. He joins us to talk about Live to Ride, finding joy and meaning on a bicycle. Peter, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks, great to be here.
Well, in the introduction to the book, you talk about bike culture and in fact that it's divided sometimes up into tribes. And that over time, your feelings about that bike culture have changed. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think historically, a lot of people who ride have just felt rather than being a part of this big tent, belong to the smaller group. They think I'm a mountain biker, or I'm a bike commuter, or I'm a fitness enthusiast or a racer. And, you know, depending on what kind of bike they sit on and what clothes they wear, they have felt like they were in this subgroup. And what I've seen in the last 10 years, really picking up speed lately, is like the signs of unification, that people realizing that they have way more in common with other riders than they previously thought, and that there's like strength in the culture to be had by everyone feeling connected.
And as you also note in the introduction, this book is really about that. It's about what ties all bikers together. So we won't have time to talk about everything in the book, but give us a quick overview of what readers are going to find here.
Right. So I started writing the book early in the pandemic when there was the biggest boom in riding since the 70s. And I started just thinking, like, why is it that everybody rides? And where I settled was to have each chapter be about an idea that nearly everyone who rides cares about. So it's like this search for adventure, this desire to be close to nature, this form of self-expression, and so on. And with this idea of, like, even if people didn't see that unification, that they'd read and they go, oh yeah, like I love riding in the park or by the ocean, and I remember what it's like to discover a new neighborhood when I was a kid, and I still feel that way now that I'm an adult. And, you know, I hope the book is, like, in some small way opening people's eyes to how much we all have in common if we ride.
Yeah, you say, I think I'm going to get this paraphrasing it wrong, but basically, if you ride a bike, you're doing okay. That's the right way to do it. And we shouldn't be thinking about all these different subcategories.
Yeah, so the exact wording is, if you're riding a bike, you're doing it right. So you were very close to perfect there. And I do think that bike culture has often had these like threads of elitism running through it, where this feeling of like, oh, there's, you know, it's like an onion where you have to peel back the layers to really become like a black belt in riding. And I think the feeling now is changing, of being way more inclusive, where people realize that if you love to ride in whatever kind of riding you do, that you're welcome, and that the culture is going to embrace you. And that's like a critical part of self-expression, is like you get to be who you want to be on a bike and feel like the culture is going to accept you for how you are.
Now, in the book, in each of those sections, you profile people who exemplify that attribute. So tell us about some of the people that you feature in the book.
Well, I'm the former editor-in-chief of Bicycling Magazine, and so I've been in this space for a long time, and I really tried to pick people who demonstrated just how broad our culture is. There's a couple of black bike racers who've brought the sport to a new demographic. There's an advocate who's really done a wonderful job speaking out for heavy riders and making people with any kind of body feel welcome. There's Greg LeMond, probably the most famous American bike racer of all time, is in there. There's Gary Fisher, one of the co-inventors of the mountain bike. There's women who've like radically brought inclusion to those spaces. You know, really just try to show people how it reflects the broader culture that we're a part of like wanting everyone to feel welcome.
So bike riding has been part of your life forever, basically. So what is it about bike riding that speaks to you?
Well, you know, I think because I've been riding so long and the different kinds of riding I've done are so varied that over time I've come to just feel like it fills so many important needs for me. It's like, sure, it's exercise. It's a way for me to get to work. It's a way for me to unplug and explore where I live. It is a way for me to drive as little as possible. You know, for a lot of people, it you know, they're really in the modern era, like struggling to find time for themselves, to find a little bit of adventure in their lives. And so all those things are meaningful to me, where I think, you know, people that are really into yoga or get really into gardening, there's other ways to get those kinds of feelings. But it becomes like a lifestyle that is broader than people who are just starting might foresee.
I want to talk a little bit about bicycling as a whole. As if we see more bicycling happening around the world, what sort of impact do you think that has on many issues that we face?
I mean, I think there are so many systematic problems where riding can be part of the solution, right? Like there's problems with public health and obesity. There's concerns about climate change. There's economic concerns about the price of fuel and car insurance. There's people, you know, in this digital age that have trouble unplugging. Their traffic is horrible. You know, for all those problems, riding a bike can be an answer. It may not be the answer for everyone, and I think that's fine. It's like never something I've advocated that it's like bike riding is the solution for everyone. It doesn't have to be that. If you know, if 10% of the public does a lot of their local transport on a bike, then it changes life for the better for the other 90%, because that's like a lot less cars on the road. And so I do think it has the power to transform our culture, much like it already has in Europe.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about the content of the book, especially at the end of the book. You have some beautiful bicycles that you profile, and about how bicycles have been introduced in sort of a fashion sense, et cetera. Tell us a bit about that content.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the self-expression idea is like that each individual can, by the bike they pick or what they wear or even how they ride, express something about themselves. And I think, you know, if you just look at fashion, people do that in their regular lives all the time, that you know, or when you go to play golf, that you make choices on what you're wearing. And that's like, but in bike riding culture, there are now just so many options. You can get a bike that's made by a hand-built, you know, a bike built just for you. You can wear almost anything. Like fashion is like infiltrated bike culture. And so whether you want to look like a really colorful racer or want to look more urban or ride in jeans that are comfortable when you ride, the options are enormous now. And so I think people feel like a piece of their personality can come through when they're riding. And if you're like me, spend so many hours a week on the bike, that's great.
Well, to learn more, the book is Live to Ride, Finding Joy and Meaning on a Bicycle by Peter Flax. Peter, thank you very much for talking with me today.
It was a great conversation. I appreciate you.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 7 day and fair. Wind is from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today, thunderstorms with a high in the low 90s. Wind will be from the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. It's 7 day and fair. From KPR's 24-hour weather center, I'm Maria Lopez.
You love your dog, your cat, your kids, but could you care about, even love, an insect? These creatures live such complicated lives that are so really beautiful, but they're small, and so we don't recognize them. If I express how much joy I've gotten spending time with insects, that sounds crazy. Love in the Time of Extinction. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge. Sunday at 10 a.m. here on Kansas Public Radio.
In 2018, the United States government finally recognized six Virginia Indian tribes.
What a day. Sorry for the emotions. It's been a long time coming.
This recognition allowed the tribes to start putting their own government infrastructure in place. Things like a constitution, a police force, and a court system.
Indigenous people and tribal nations are really well positioned to think about what America could look like. And I think we have the ability to think about what a better community or a better nation could mean.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today on the show, Making a Justice System. One of the Virginia tribes that gained federal recognition in 2018 was the Upper Mattaponi. With Good Reason producer Lauren Francis visited the Upper Mattaponi chief, Frank Adams, and spoke with him about this historic step forward for tribal sovereignty.
First time you've been on this property?
First time.
Okay.
This is Chief Frank Adams.
My name is Frank Adams. I'm the chief of the Upper Mattaponi Tribe.
Chief Adams is in his third term as chief of the Upper Mattaponi Tribe.
And right now we're standing on the beginning of our reservation.
The Upper Mattaponi has existed for hundreds of years, but it wasn't until 2018 that the federal government recognized them, along with several other Virginia tribes. Federal recognition means a lot of different things. Like, they're now eligible for federal funding, for things like the COVID-era CARES Act grants. They've used that funding to purchase their land back and start businesses.
This is a wonderful property.
Chief Adams remembers his mother and other ancestors penny-pinching to buy the land we're standing on here.
This is property that my mother and other ancestors purchased when we had no money. So everybody gave up some money to the tribe to make a down payment. And then we had powwows, bake sales, turkey shoots, yard sales, and all just to pay the mortgage on this for about 25 years.
In 2018, the tribe owned 32 acres of land. Now, in 2024, the Upper Mattaponi has reclaimed 1,700 acres of land. And because they now have federal recognition, that land can go into a federal trust.
Since we are putting these lands into federal trust, that means we have complete jurisdiction over them, including the laws we pass and enforcing those laws on tribal land.
For the past 6 years, the tribe has been working on establishing its government, first by rewriting its constitution.
Before we had the constitution that we have now, we had seven people in leadership, which was five council people, a chief and assistant chief, and we all had equal vote when issues came up with the tribe.
The new constitution establishes laws in three branches of government. Those new laws will be upheld by the new judicial branch.
So if we're going to start making laws that people will invariably break, then we have to enforce them, so we establish our own tribal court.
The Upper Mattaponi tribe will enforce laws on the land that they own. So if there's a domestic dispute on the reservation, for example, that would be handled by tribal courts, not the King William County Police Department. And if someone were caught fishing or hunting during the county's off-season, they'd be held accountable by the tribe, not the county. The tribe has an agreement with the sheriff's department. The department offers support by invitation only.
Cases that we will try is like if someone is fishing or hunting, we try to get everybody to follow the state guidelines for hunting and fishing regulations. But if someone's children or family is hungry and they go fishing and catch fish for them to eat and feed their family, we are not going to throw them in jail for feeding their family. So, I mean, that case will be cut and dried in a tribal court that we understand why you're doing this. You're not selling the fish. You're not wasting the fish. You're feeding your hungry children.
There's no physical courtroom yet, but there are judges for the tribe interviewed and selected. None of them are Upper Mattaponi members.
We hired three judges. One of them is a tribal member. But you got to remember that everybody in our tribe is kin to everybody else some kind of way. So it's really hard for cousins to try two other cousins and make an unbiased decision. So we've got tribal members from other tribes who are the other two judges we have.
While the tribe works on building out its physical courtroom, they're holding court virtually. And if anyone is convicted, they'll be held at the King William County Jail for now.
But eventually we will have a tribal police force, a tribal fire department, tribal courts, and detention center.
They haven't tried a case yet, but they're prepared.
We have hired judges. We have applied to the federal government for funding to set up a court system, you know, to buy the computers and the equipment that's needed for the court system. Fortunately, we haven't tried a case yet, but I'm sure that's coming pretty soon.
For With Good Reason, this is Lauren Francis.
After visiting with Chief Adams, Lauren sat down with Savannah Baber. Savannah is the coordinator for Virginia Indian Programs here at With Good Reason's home, Virginia Humanities. She descends from both the Chickahominy Tribe of Virginia and the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, and she spent years digging into the complexities and potential of tribal governance.
So, Savannah, what does it mean for the Upper Mattaponi Tribe to have federal recognition?
Great question. In the same way that the United States has an international political relationship with Canada, the United States has a relationship built through treaties and other legal agreements with tribal nations that it then affirms through the process of federal recognition. So in the case of tribes here in Virginia, the British colonial government actually recognized tribes in Virginia as like international entities that they needed to enter into political relationships with. Of course, after the American Revolution, all of that goes away really quickly. Mm-hmm. And in most of the cases, the United States government actually did not honor the relationship that the British government had established with these tribes here in Virginia. So we've really spent the last 300 or so years trying to get the United States to recognize that relationship and honor it as it should be.
So can you tell me about what this federal recognition has made possible in the way of sovereignty for the Upper Mattaponi?
Federal recognition acknowledges and reaffirms the nation-to-nation relationship between the United States and tribal nations. And it also means that there are certain responsibilities on behalf of the United States towards the tribal nations because of the things that tribal nations gave up via treaties or, again, military conflicts or whatever else. Some of those things include healthcare, access to federal programs for housing or education, including land reservation and trust as well. One of the things that the Upper Mattaponi Indian Tribe has acted quickly on since 2018 is establishing their own land base and then working to get that land put into trust with the United States so that they can now exercise their authority and jurisdiction over that territory. One way that tribes exercise authority and jurisdiction is through laws and law enforcement. And so the Upper Mattapani Indian Tribe has worked to draft a new constitution that include a legislative branch, an executive branch, and a judicial branch. So they have established themselves as the local authority over their citizenry and their land base. Establishing that court system, that judicial system, is a direct exercise of their tribal sovereignty through governance.
Has any other Virginia tribe ever established its own court system?
This is the first tribal court system that is recognized by the federal government via the bureaus in Virginia. So I'm sure others will follow soon, mm-hmm. but the Upper Mattapani Indian Tribe are the first official one.
Wow. What does it mean to have a court system within a court system?
We can think of it as somewhat of a parallel to how state court systems operate within the federal judicial system. You know, states have their own laws and regulations that they enforce, but then obviously there's federal laws and regulations that are enforceable as well. So tribes really kind of become a third agent in that arrangement. It is complicated. Mm-hmm. It's a very complicated legal topic, but in terms of power, tribal nations are independent of their states and are sovereign entities within a state.
It's interesting because when I think of the idea of being sovereign, I think of like totally independent. But it sounds like not only is there a partnership between the tribes and the state and federal government, but that there's also not necessarily a goal to go beyond that. Like there's always going to be interconnectedness. Is that the case?
I would say so. I think interconnectedness is a good word for it. I think that there is a recognition that tribal nations are sovereign, but individual tribal citizens should have every right mm-hmm. of an American citizen, because otherwise you could truly begin to look at the territorial jurisdictions and reservations of tribal nations as punitive. You know, if you mm-hmm. can't travel beyond that territory and enjoy the rights of citizenship, mm-hmm. that gets into some really gray area. Mm-hmm. And the trust responsibility of the United States to tribal nations is to provide things like education and healthcare to tribal nations. It's essentially the agreement that we took your land, mm-hmm. right? You know, we wanted your land, so we took it. But because we took it, we're going to make sure that you have these other things. And there are honestly a lot of different political perspectives on American citizenship for tribal nations. Mm-hmm. And some American Indian legal scholars do not think that the American Indian Citizenship Act was a positive for tribal nations. Mm. Because some people would argue that tribal nations need to be more independent of the United States, and they're actually not interested in that trust relationship. But I think the general trend has been that American citizenship is expected or just like a natural right of Native American people. And obviously it's been 100 years since that was passed. So it's the thing that we live with and the thing that we do.
I'm really fascinated by this idea that the federal recognition is not just about what the tribe can now do, but it's also, as you said, about what the United States essentially owes to people in the tribe. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah. You know, we can look at the impact of something like the Indian Health Service on the communities that tribal nations currently reside in. The majority of our tribal nations are in extremely rural areas that have been underserved for a very long time in a variety of ways. So the Indian Health Service is a way that really, tribal citizens are accessing direct health care for the first time. They're building a clinic in Charles City, which is a really rural area that has been underserved by health care for a long time. Pharmacies and just having access to health insurance through the Indian Health Service is going to be a big deal. And so that's going to really change the game.
So one of the things that the chief and I talked about is the fact that within the tribe, everyone's related, right? So how does that affect the court system?
Yeah, I think it brings up some really interesting questions. For instance, like, what is a jury of your peers? You know, does that include your cousins? is that your peer? But I think that it also brings a really human quality to what this court system could be and to what we think about justice when we think about how we know people. If we take into account somebody's entire life story when we're thinking about their case, does that change the outcome? I think it could, in probably some positive ways and potentially some negative ways in some cases. But I think it does necessitate deeper inquiry into what justice means in community when we think about people who have lived in a place for generations, centuries, millennia. What does keeping them in community mean as a mechanism of justice? It becomes a question of how do we restore them to our community? How do we make our community work again in light of whatever it is that has happened? Ideally, for me, it would mean that they come out stronger on the other end and with a really strong definition of what community means to them and what their norms and expectations of one another are. And I think that like when those things are really clear, maybe your court system doesn't even get used as much as you think it would, because people know what the expectations are. They know what the norms are. They know what the laws are, and they know what the consequences of those laws are. You're having a direct impact on people that you know and are related to. And so I think if we see a justice system that is about that impact, as opposed to just like legal consequences, we'll potentially see a change in how justice is defined and also like levied on their community.
What excites you the most about this?
What excites me the most is the opportunity to imagine different futures for ourselves. Also to potentially influence the political imagination of the communities around us. Indigenous people and tribal nations are really well positioned to think about what America could look like. And I think we have the ability to think about what a better community or a better nation could mean. So we can think about what a justice system that has, you know, restoration at the center of it, as opposed to punishment, could actually look like and how it could actually play out. And some of these experiments could fail, you know, and I think that that's also really exciting, mm-hmm. that we have the opportunity to try new things and potentially fail, but ultimately, like, ideally learn from it. So yeah, I think it's all the possibility that really excites me to govern potentially in a better way than what we have been subjected to through colonization and assimilation and all these other really violent and like racist policies that we mm-hmm. have been the victims of. It's like we get to take our power back and to reimagine our futures for ourselves beyond victimhood mm-hmm. and instead from like a place of empowerment and self-reliance and self-determination.
Well, Savannah, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for coming down the hall to hang out with us at With Good Reason.
Thanks for having me.
Savannah Baber is the coordinator for Virginia Indian Programs at Virginia Humanities. What makes a court? You might say something like there's a judge with legal training, makes a judgment, and has the power to punish. But actually, none of that's necessary for a court. My next guest says all over the world there are courts that operate very differently. David Law, yep, that's right, Law, is a professor at the University of Virginia Law School. David, when in your legal career did you first become intrigued with the structure and inner workings of the court system?
Well, it probably started in law school when you would study and pore over these judicial decisions as if they were holy scripture and you were being indoctrinated into something like a cult of the court. And yet you never really took a look at the institution itself. You'd have legal materials, arguments, cases, briefs going in one end, and then out would pop this judicial decision on the other hand. And you would treat that, again, like scripture and pore over every word, every comma, try to parse, squeeze every last bit of meaning out of every word and period. But the court itself remained a black box. And once in a while, someone would say something like, well, you know, it matters who the judges are. But it would pretty much end there. And beyond that, we had no sense or understanding or discussion of what difference does it make what is happening inside that box, how that box is organized. Here you have this incredibly important institution that is pretty much as old as human organized society or the state itself, namely courts, and yet we so rarely study them. Typical law school curriculum doesn't have anything that is specifically about courts. That is not a good way to understand our core institution.
And then when did you start to understand more about the courts, the black box?
I had the opportunity to do a fellowship in Japan with the Council on Foreign Relations, and I studied the Japanese Supreme Court. And it turned out that the Japanese Supreme Court is like any other institution. It's full of people with competing agendas and resources and incentives, and the situation they find themselves in, the people they're around, all of that shapes the way they behave. All of that shapes what happens. It taught me not to assume that the only thing that matters to a court's behavior is who the judges are. It also matters, for example, what kinds of resources they have, what kinds of challenges they're facing. Think about the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court has 9 justices who decide on the merits, less than 100 cases a year. The Japanese Supreme Court has 15 justices, and they decide about 10,000 cases per year. The U.S. Supreme Court justices choose their clerks who will help them. They each get 4. The Japanese Supreme Court justices, not only are they more reliant on their help, they don't get to choose their own clerks. The clerks are chosen by judicial administrators, and they're chosen for their compliance and discipline and adherence to the judicial bureaucracy. So you have these incredibly overworked justices who have assistants who don't do what the justices necessarily want them to do. You can't tell me that that doesn't explain a lot of things about the Japanese Supreme Court, such as the fact that they almost never strike down laws. They're institutionally bound, those justices. They're prisoners of their own institution. We think of justices as being these grand beings who serve for life and are untouchable and can't be controlled. That is not the case for the Japanese Supreme Court. And the Japanese Supreme Court is not alone.
So how important are courts? Have we needed them in human society since time immemorial?
I can't think of any institution more fundamental than courts. Think about what courts do. Courts resolve disputes peacefully. Can you imagine social or political ordering without nonviolent third-party dispute resolution? It's hard. You might get that in small, tight-knit communities where everybody knows each other, everyone's on the same page, and so there's this kind of unspoken, informal order where you never need to resort to third parties. But that's rare, and that's not the society we live in today. If you talk about diverse, large, post-industrial societies full of strangers, you need third-party dispute resolution.
And do we need courts the way they're structured typically in America?
Court systems absolutely do not need to be structured the way that we structure them. In fact, the way we structure them is a bit unusual. We have this legal system inherited from the British, where we recruit our judges from, generally speaking, from the bar. People who are esteemed and well-known are selected, or in many cases in the states, they run for election. But the majority of jurisdictions, judging is a government job, basically a civil service job. You go to school, and then you go to judge school, and you take exams. And if you do well in your exams, you get a judgeship. And maybe you get a judgeship in a prime city, and you work your way up the ladder. That's actually more common. All of the countries of continental Europe and all of the legal systems that they have spawned. So, for example, France and Germany in turn inspired Japan. Japan went on to impose its system on Taiwan and Korea. And so you've got the system that spans the entire globe.
That's a better system, right? We don't train our judges to be judges.
It is not necessarily better. It is different. If you like the idea of judges thinking of themselves just as people who are just there to apply the law, as bureaucrats, then you might like the civil law system. If you feel that that is in some sense intellectually dishonest and judges can't help but make the law, so shouldn't we face the consequences of lawmaking judges and have selection mechanisms that hold them accountable for the power they exercise? Maybe you don't like the civil law system.
What sort of judge do you want? I think I want a judge who's using her or his independent judgment and employing wisdom and heart and a deep knowledge and a deep experience.
It's been a question people have long asked because many systems, not just ours, make use of lay people, people who have no special legal training, to engage in judging. Here in this country, for example, we have juries, right? That's a long-held, long-cherished institution. We also, at the state level, have justices of the peace, magistrates, who often do not have law degrees, do not need to have law degrees. In fact, in early American history, the state of Massachusetts, for example, forbade people who were lawyers from becoming judges. And that remains common in other places, just England and Wales, from which we got our legal system. You have magistrates there who aren't judges and are assisted by clerks in their courts who are legally trained. The proof is in the pudding here. We know for a fact that legal systems can operate with judges who aren't lawyers. We know that. So I don't think that that is clearly not a requirement of a successful judicial system.
Are there extrajudicial systems that work very well in the U.S.?
Yes. So there are, again, some situations in which it is not necessary to resort to the courts at all. There is this famous book, in law circles at least, by Robert Ellickson at Yale Law School, Order Without Law, where he talks about the ranchers in Shasta County, California, and how they resolve disputes without resorting to courts. And there you have kind of an ideal scenario for non-judicial dispute resolution. This is a small community of people who deal with each other day in, day out. And they have their own norms and understandings. They know each other. And if there's a problem, they know they have to deal with each other on an ongoing basis. And, you know, you try not to screw people of the power to screw you back later, right? And is that any less effective than having some federal district court issue some order that might or might not be enforced at some point down the road? Experience would suggest that it's at least as effective. In fact, we have a lot of courts throughout the world, throughout history, that don't have any formal enforcement power. And the question is, how do they succeed? How do they operate? And the answer is, sometimes you don't need enforcement for decisions to be complied with.
And yet, what gives courts their power? Is it the threat of jail and fines and the surety that those will follow if one doesn't comply?
Yeah, I think that's a widespread assumption that it's an essential part of the definition of a court, that it has some kind of enforcement power. But it's simply not true. And if you think about a world in which it's necessary to hold a gun to someone's head in order to get them to comply with the rules, now sometimes that's necessary. Sometimes you're dealing with people in situations where you really do have to coerce them. But there are no societies that have enough resources to force compliance in every instance. Social order, political order depend on voluntary compliance all of the time. Now, there are a lot of reasons why people comply voluntarily. For example, if they're dealing with people they have to deal with again tomorrow and the day after that, right? So you're thinking about what happens down the road. And if you have to think about the consequences of your actions for later, that's a powerful incentive to behave. So that may explain, for example, why if you look at the International Court of Justice, right, it decides international border disputes. You know, newsflash, there's no international super police the UN is going to send in to enforce those judgments. And yet the International Court of Justice has something like a 70%+ compliance rate. Historically, this is super common too. If you look at California under Mexican rule, Mexican California had judicial officials, but their judgments were not enforced by the state in civil cases. They were only enforced in criminal cases, and yet people still complied.
And does the center hold? Is the U.S. court system standing up?
There are some societies where you can deal them a really great hand of legal and political institutions, and it just won't matter because the fundamental conditions are too terrible, the too much conflict at too profound of a level. And there are institutions where you can come up with the most cockamamie institutions you could imagine, and they'll still do fine. And I think that we here in this country, as are most countries, are in neither heaven or hell. I think we're in purgatory. I think we are in the zone where these institutions make a difference, and hopefully they help us. This is a country that's blessed in many ways. It's wealthy. It's peaceful. On the other hand, it is very heterogeneous, very diverse, and there are a lot of disagreements to work out. And those disagreements are not going away. They can't be assumed away. And the question is, how do we work through them?
David Law, thank you for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you for having me.
David S. Law is the E. James Kelly Jr. Class of 1965, Professor of Law at the University of Virginia Law School. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Andrew Rice is our intern. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, FM 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, FM 89.7. KANV and KANV HD City, FM 91.3. KANQ Chanute, FM 90.3. And online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. It's 70 and fair. Wind is from the east at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today, thunderstorms with a high in the low 90s. Wind will be from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high around 102. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-70s. It's 70 and fair. From KPR's 24-hour weather center, I'm Maria Lopez.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Debbie Elliott. Good morning. Coming up, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg talks about holding airlines accountable, and we visit New Orleans for a once-overlooked piece of American history.
You know, it's not Buckingham Palace. It's not St. Louis Cathedral. It's not...
It's a school building.
It's a school building.
A civil rights pioneer has restored one of the first desegregated schools in the Deep South. Also, a finalist in the Tiny Desk Contest talks about making music during chemotherapy. It's Sunday, July 28th. The news is coming up next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. Israel is holding the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah responsible for a rocket attack this weekend that killed 12 children and young adults while they were playing soccer in the Golan Heights. Thousands turned out for funerals today. Hezbollah denies any role in the attack, but Israeli military spokesman Daniel Hagari says the evidence points to Hezbollah.
This rocket was a rocket called Falak 1. It is manufactured in Iran. It is delivered to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the only terror organization in Lebanon that holds Falak 1.
The Israeli military says it struck a series of Hezbollah targets in Lebanon overnight. There are no reports of casualties, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said the price has yet to be paid. Vice President Kamala Harris continuing to evaluate potential running mates and people familiar with her deliberations say she has not yet narrowed down the field. NPR's Tamara Keith reports on the vetting process, which is by necessity being dramatically compressed from a normal timeline.
The running mate selection process would normally take months, but for Vice President Harris, her deliberation period can best be measured in days. One source familiar with her thinking said Harris was looking for a vice president with executive experience and someone who could be a governing partner with her, among other considerations. That person declined to share names of people being vetted. A second source said Harris's team was vetting about a dozen potential candidates for the job and also declined to give names of people being vetted. The sources spoke on condition of anonymity.
You're listening to NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday, here on your place for NPR News, Kansas Public Radio. Mostly sunny today, highs near 92, slight chance for rain this afternoon. Right now it's sunny and 70 degrees in Lawrence at 6 minutes after 7. Good morning.
You're listening to NPR News.
You're listening to NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday here on your place for NPR News, Kansas, Public Radio 91.5 in Lawrence, and 89.7 Emporia, online, kansaspublicradio.org. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll hear from a pioneer of school desegregation in the Deep South. She's preserving a piece of New Orleans civil rights history, the Lower Ninth Ward School, that she helped to integrate in 1960. We'll hear more about that also ahead in this next half hour. Early voting has gotten underway in Michigan's primaries this weekend. One of the major questions is who will become the party's nominee for the seat of retiring Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow. We'll hear more about that coming up in 20 minutes. Actually, in about 15 minutes. On Weekend Edition here on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Environmental, providing solutions for mold, asbestos, and other indoor environmental quality issues since 1982 for clients ranging from private homeowners to realtors to corporations. More information at cromwellenvironmental.com.
Next time on KPR Presents, what can Mother Earth teach us about climate change? We'll hear from Dan Wildcat of Haskell Indian Nations University. He'll join us to talk about his latest book on indigenuity. Kay McIntyre is our host. KPR Presents here at 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio. Another sunny and hot day. Afternoon highs officially around 92. The heat index values will make it feel warmer than that. Slight chance for rain this afternoon. It's 71 degrees now at 720.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. With
Detro, we take a look at three potential contenders for Harris's VP pick on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Kansas Public Radio. Tune in for Morning Edition tomorrow morning starting at 5 a.m. and we bring you All Things Considered throughout the week as well. Monday through Friday, your host is Laura Larson, starting at 3 o'clock in the afternoons.
Snyder with these headlines. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is holding the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah responsible for a rocket attack that hit a soccer field in the Golan Heights yesterday. 12 children and young adults were killed. Hezbollah denies any role in the attack, but Netanyahu says the group will pay a heavy price. The Israeli military launched attacks on several Hezbollah targets in Lebanon overnight. Venezuelans are going to the polls today to decide whether to hand President Nicolas Maduro a third term. The election is being called Venezuela's most consequential in 25 years. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are in Tokyo today, meeting with their Japanese counterparts amid concern about North Korea's nuclear program and China's ambition in the region. This is NPR News.
Taking a look at our weather forecast, it looks as if we will have mostly sunny conditions today with highs near 92 degrees. A slight chance for rain this afternoon. Right now it's sunny and 71 degrees in Lawrence.
Support for KPR comes from Pines Garden and Market, carrying a full line of farm-fresh local produce, including tomatoes, sweet corn, peaches, and other grades of Midwestern produce. Open 7 days a week in North Lawrence. Details at PinesGardenMarket.com.
Through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU, and KANU, HD1 Lawrence, 91.5. KANH and KANH, HD1 Emporia, 89.7, KANV and KANV, HD1 Olsburg, Junction City, 91.3, KANQ Chanute, 90.3, and you can find us online, listen live online at kansaspublicradio.org, or ask your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Kansas Tree Care, local arborists who provide professional tree care in the greater Lawrence area and who can be reached at kansastreecare.com or at 785-843-TREE.
This afternoon on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panel will weigh in on the top news stories of the week. Also, musician and best-selling author Kathleen Hanna stops by to talk about her life as a pioneer in the punk rock feminist movement. All that coming up on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, today at noon on KPR1. Mostly sunny and hot today, highs near 92 degrees, slight chance for rain this afternoon. It's already 78 degrees and sunny at 8 o'clock. This is Kansas Public Radio.
Which will reveal fairly quickly who is responsible. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Venezuelans are going to the polls today to decide whether to hand President Nicolas Maduro a third term. The election is being called Venezuela's most consequential in 25 years. The opposition has united behind a single candidate. And you're listening to NPR News.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Tom Parkinson, in for Kay McIntyre this week on Weekend Edition. It's 4 minutes after eight. Former President Donald Trump has endorsed former State Attorney General of Kansas, Derek Schmidt, in the five-candidate Republican Party primary in the 2nd Congressional District of Kansas. Trump said he was impressed that Schmidt was reelected Attorney General in 2016 and 2020 by wide margins. The Kansas Reflector reports that five candidates have entered the Republican primary for the seat being vacated by U.S. Representative Jake LaTourneur, who decided against seeking reelection to Congress. Schmidt has consistently led the Republican field by double digits in polling and says he's honored to receive former President Trump's endorsements. Officials at Kansas Athletics at the University of Kansas say construction at the David Booth Memorial Stadium is on track, and the new stadium is expected to be ready to host football games in about a year. The first game on the schedule will pit the Jayhawks against Fresno State on August 23, 2025. The Lawrence Journal-World reports that the first phase of the renovation project has a price tag of about $450 million, targeting the north and west sides of the stadium. For this season, the Jayhawks will split home games between Children's Mercy Park in Kansas City, Kansas for the first two home games, and GEHA Field at Arrowhead Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri for the final four home games. Northeast Kansas can expect more extreme heat this week, with temperatures expected to climb above 100 degrees tomorrow through Thursday, after having seen the temperature reach the century mark 2 days so far this year. That was just last month. The National Weather Service in Topeka predicts the region will see high temperatures, sunny skies, and highs near 100 tomorrow, 102 on Tuesday, 105 Wednesday, and 102 degrees on Thursday as well. Those, by the way, are actual temperatures. The heat index values predicted to climb to between 105 and 115 degrees. Today, sunny with highs near 92. Right now, we've got sunshine and 74 degrees at 6 minutes after 8 o'clock.
You're listening to NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR's Weekend Edition on this Sunday morning. It's 18 minutes after 8 o'clock. I'm Tom Parkinson, sitting in for Kay McIntyre on this Sunday morning. The specter of doping hangs over the Paris Olympics, stemming from an ongoing scandal in the last Summer Games. In those games, more than 20 Chinese swimmers competed after testing positive. We'll hear more about that. Coming up next, also ahead in this next segment, a Sig Sauer pistol used by the military is at the center of allegations that the gun has a serious design flaw, making it susceptible to firing without the trigger being pulled. It's not good. We'll hear more about that coming up in 10 minutes on Weekend Edition here on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Collar Press. Blue Collar Press has been helping businesses, musicians, and artists, big and small, turn ideas into promotional merchandise for 20 years. More information at bluecollarpress.com.
Hope you can join us tonight for an encore broadcast of Live at the Green Lady Lounge. Tonight, featuring Wiretown, that consists of two of the greatest guitar players in Kansas City, Danny Embry and Brian Baggett. Hope you can join us for Live at the Green Lady Lounge tonight at 9 o'clock on KPR 1 stations. Mostly sunny today with afternoon highs near 92 degrees. Slight chance, less than 20% chance, of passing shower in the afternoon. Right now it's sunny and 74 degrees.
Support for NPR comes from the station.
For their safety or out of frustration with Israel's current leadership.
It's like being foreign in my own country. We are kidnapped by this government.
Israelis leaving Israel Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tune in tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. for Morning Edition here on Kansas Public Radio every weekday morning from 5 to 9. Here on KPR, it's your place for NPR News, 91.5 in Lawrence, 99.5 in Manhattan. Online, we're at kansaspublicradio.org. It's 20 minutes before 9 o'clock. Coming up just after 9 o'clock, we'll have latest news headlines from around our region and from around the world from NPR in Washington. And then, Debbie Elliott will speak with U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg about recent flight cancellations due to the CrowdStrike tech outage. She'll ask the Secretary about accountability for some of the airlines. That's ahead just after 9 o'clock. Coming up in a few minutes, though, Debbie Elliott talks to writer and director M. Night Shyamalan. And actor-singer Salika Shyamalan, the father and daughter duo, have collaborated on a new movie, a new thriller. It's called Trap. We'll hear all about that. It's ahead as Weekend Edition continues here on KPR.
Support for the coverage of health news on KPR comes from the Sunflower Foundation. Based in Topeka, the Sunflower Foundation serves as a catalyst for improving the health of all Kansans. More information is available at sunflowerfoundation.org.
Next time on KPR Presents, what can Mother Earth teach us about climate change? We'll hear from Dan Wildcat of Haskell Indian Nations University. We'll talk about his latest book on indigenuity. Kay McIntyre's your host for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio. It's 8:42.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott. A new movie opens with a father-daughter field trip. Minivan, music on, impatient tween girl singing along to the pop star she idolizes and is about to see live in concert.
Go, 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 Dad.
We're not going to break any laws, Riley. Get there when you want to get there. I promise. Trust me.
But don't be mistaken, this is no sweet family drama. It's from M. Night Shyamalan, the writer
tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
We're live, we're local, we're Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU. and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or just ask your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Cromwell Environmental, serving Kansas and Missouri customers since 1982, offering testing and solutions for mold, lead, and asbestos problems. More information at cromwellenvironmental.com.
Mostly sunny and hot once again today, not nearly as hot as it will be in the next few days. Today, we're expecting an afternoon high near 92 degrees, a slight chance, about 20% chance perhaps, of rain in the afternoon, just a passing shower maybe. And then tonight, partly cloudy, lows drop to 75. We do have a 30% chance for rain tonight after midnight. The National Weather Service has issued an excessive heat watch for the week ahead. The warning will be in effect from tomorrow afternoon through Thursday evening, with heat index values as high as 114 degrees. It's 9 o'clock.